got an auditor on there.
Yes, the auditor.
Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is Thursday, September the 9th. The time is 9 a.m. Everyone remembers the cell phone drill. Present today, Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, and
yeah, good morning.
Good morning, sir. And Senator Wilikowski.
Good morning.
Call me and visit once in a while. I never hear from you. Anyway, good morning, everyone. Staff, thanks for being here today and all the committee aides. On today's agenda, we've got SJR 5, Constitutional Amendment, Appropriation Limit, Budget Reserve Fund, and bills previously heard. Our Constitutional Appropriation Budget Reserve is the first hearing in Senate Finance. Our intention is to hear an introduction and a sectional analysis and set this bill aside. So for the bill's introduction and presentation, Mr. Steininger, Director of OMB, Caroline Schultz, Policy Analyst, OMB, are here and available for questions, is also Mr. Milks, Assistant General, Department of Law, and Caroline, good morning. She's here to back up Mr. Steininger. So with that, floor is yours if there's not any other opening comments from committee members. Seeing none, please proceed.
Good morning. For the record, Neil Steininger, Office of Management and Budget.
Good morning. This is Caroline Schultz from the Office of Management and Budget.
Thank you for inviting us here today to talk about SJR 5, the governor's constitutional amendment to address the constitutional spending limit. So here on slide 2 is a graph showing the current constitutional spending limit in Article 9, Section 16. That's represented by the dark black line. The reason that we're presenting an amendment to the constitutional spending limit is because the current constitutional spending limit isn't really effective at controlling expenditures of the state. You can see that over the time period of this graph from the institution of the current constitutional spending limit to today, there really aren't any time periods where state expenditures neared or exceeded or came close to exceeding the constitutional spending limit. I mean, you see the green lines represent revenue here, the orange expenditures. And what's clear from this graph is over this time period, the amount of revenues available was what controlled expenditures. So during time periods where there were low amounts of revenue or flat amounts of revenue, expenditures stayed roughly in line with that available revenue. While at that same period, the spending limit in the Constitution continued to escalate and grow, creating a pretty significant gap between the amount of expenditures and the limit on expenditures. So when revenue started to spike in the early aughts, you can see that expenditures were able to go up at roughly the same rate as those expenditures or as those revenues. And there really wasn't any meaningful limit on that rate of growth during that time period. That reason that forward-looking need to create constraint on a run-up in state expenditures is why we're contemplating and recommending an amendment to the constitutional spending limit. Here, just for illustrative purposes, we've overlaid a dotted line that shows if the limit as laid out in SJR 5 had been applied at the same time as the current constitutional spending limit. And you can see that it would have provided a lot more constraint on growth of expenditures during the time period of that run-up in revenue in the early aughts, and would have provided a lot more constraint in the ability to grow government spending during that time period.
Questions? Senator Stedman?
I'm just kind of curious. It looks like there's quite the delta between the dotted line, which is the hypothetical look back of the proposal here, and then where we're at in our operations It looks like expenditures are $4.5 billion rounded off, and on your dotted line, it's somewhere down around $3 billion. So how would we get from 4.5 to $3 billion under this scenario?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, you know, one thing about this graph and doing this hypothetical look back is, you know, it's presenting a kind of what-if scenario. However, if we implement SGR 5 now, it wouldn't actually be down at that $3.5 billion level. It would be more responsive to current expenditures. So we're not suggesting that we implement a spending limit that requires, you know, roughly $1 billion in reductions immediately. We're looking to implement a spending limit that constrains future growth. And one of the reasons there, and the problem that is kind of highlighted in that question, is that when expenditures run up, it's very easy to add new expenditures to the state budget when there's available revenue. It's far more challenging to, you know, pull some of those operating costs back out of the budget on the other side when revenues decline. You can see a pretty, you know, significant decline initially when revenue dropped, but then we've stabilized since, and it's much harder to kind of claw those things back. So we're not suggesting that we base this expenditure limit based on this historical look back. It's more of just to illustrate how it is this mechanism that we've designed in SGR 5 is more restrictive than the current constitutional spending limit.
Follow up, Senator?
Just to shift gears a little bit. We've had this subject matter in front of the committee many, many times over the last several decades. And we've all recognized that the constitutional spending limit is quite a bit above our actual expenditures as reflected here. But under the previous governor, Governor Walker, the spending limit was in the middle of the table, and there was discussions about it with similar drivers or very close to this similar multipliers to have your spending cap continue to increase. But if we would have implemented some of those proposed spending caps from then Senator Dunleavy, it would be significantly higher than we are today in allowing us to increase the appropriations where we're at today, yet we have maintained flat budgets for three different legislatures. This is the fourth legislature, and the current governor and the last governor. So, you know, I'm a little bit suspect that it would be effective, and we don't even have to go back to the first Senator Dunleavy's proposal. We could go to his second or third proposal over the tenure, go back 2 years as a starting point. And I don't see the operating budget of the state advancing. We have the opposite challenge, is how to meet our obligations with the current non-constitutional spending cap, but the current spending cap that's in the middle of the table today, which is the 5% payout of the percent of market value. And there's a significant amount of legislators, they don't like being up against a spending cap, and they want to spend more. So I'm a little bit gun-shy when we go through this proposal, and there's at least two other proposals that we are actually looking at something that would be as effective or more effective than what we currently have that's stopping our spending growth as we sit here today. And we have very little flexibility, you know, with the funds available to do any escalation in growth, Mr. Chairman. So I would like to have, you know, instead of a look back on this chart going back to 1982, I'd like to have a look back to the beginning of the Walker administration, and or the last year of Governor Parnell. Give us, you know, several years back, or even go back 4 years and start it going forward, and we can actually see where we're at. Because if my concern is we come in with a spending cap, we know the current one in the Constitution is dysfunctional. There's no question about that. But if we come in with a spending cap that's significantly higher than we are today, you know, over the next 2-3 years, it gives us a lot of headroom. There's going to be a lot of interest within this structure in the legislature to spend up to it. And I just think that's the wrong direction. So it'd be nice to have, if we could, have this restated and remodeled with a much tighter time frame, so we can see, and they could pick which years they want to use, but it should be somewhere between 2015 and present.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments from committee members? So, Mr. Steininger, you heard Senator Stedman on his request for a restatement. And I just like to add, you know, we've got the other former co-chair of the budget here, and you look at these years. I think it's important to do that because, you know, from the years when they sat here at this table and banked $17 billion in this little bit of a spike here, I think you need to tell the whole story for those public that are watching. We have a tremendous amount of deferred maintenance, and a lot of this UGF spending was capital, right? And I know what you're I've read through all your slides, and I've got some questions on the capital spending, what's outside of the spending limit when we get there. But just for those listening, public at home, we were up against a $2 billion deferred maintenance just on state assets. So just park that for a minute. We're $1 billion in deferred maintenance in rural Alaska through our fuel tank storage, energy upgrades, et cetera, et cetera. So there's $3 billion, right? And we just want to be careful that we don't handcuff ourselves to fix that deferred maintenance within our state assets and our fixed assets in rural Alaska as it pertains to water, sewer, energy, bulk fuel storage, et cetera, et cetera. Schools, they're going in the rivers and villages, et cetera. So let's be cognizant of that and as we're having these discussions. So thank you. Next.
Thank you. And one thing I'll say through the chair, Senator Stedman, we do have a slide a little bit later in the presentation that does, you know, hopefully answers that question of reframing based on if this were implemented in those different time periods. And so we can discuss that a little bit more when we get to that slide. So on slide 3, you know, really what we're looking at here is what are the key aspects to make an appropriation limit effective? So one thing that we can acknowledge is our current constitutional appropriation limit is not very effective. So as we look at designing a new one, what aspects are we looking to, you know, enshrine in the Constitution that will create an appropriation limit that is effective, but also allows for us to respond to need? So primarily the first key aspect is that to be an effective appropriation limit, it needs to inhibit excess spending in high revenue years. So really, we're not talking about an appropriation limit that is trying to restrict activities we're undergoing right now, because right now we have a pretty effective limit on expenditure growth just through an unavailability of revenue. We're really looking forward into the future to say, should we have, you know, another windfall revenue year, you know, do we have an appropriation limit in place structured to inhibit, you know, excess spending in those future years? Not necessarily now, but trying to look forward to the future and, you know, create a mechanism to inhibit that growth later. also, to be effective, you need to have some practical considerations on the calculation. There needs to be data that's available timely that informs the appropriation limit. One of the issues that I think isn't often understood in our current appropriation limit is the data available to calculate it isn't available until the end of the fiscal year that it applies to. So we don't actually calculate the current appropriation limit until the fiscal year is closed. So that limit and that dollar value isn't really available when the governor's putting together his December budget, when the legislature is considering that budget and enacting it, or when the governor is signing it. At none of those key decision points do we actually know the true appropriation limit for that given fiscal year. And so designing an appropriation limit that considers that, you know, will help to inform those decision-making events. So that's why you need to be able to calculate it in advance. And the formula also needs to be clearly understood. That's another issue with our current appropriation limit, is that over the years, the individuals that have calculated have interpreted the language in the appropriation limit a little bit differently each year. And because it's not perfectly clearly written. And so as we've been going through the committee process with SJR 5, you know, that's something that, you know, in every conversation, making sure do people, when people read these words, do they come to the same conclusion on how to calculate the appropriation limit? And, you know, it needs to be clear, something that everybody can calculate, something that members of the public, as they're, you know, voting on a constitutional amendment, can calculate themselves just looking at the language that they're voting on. It's very important to be clearly understood. It also needs to be responsive to long-term and unanticipated changes. We need to make sure that there is, you know, sufficient headroom or sufficient flexibility for it to respond to needs that may come to the state in the future. There's a couple of different mechanisms that you can, you know, achieve that with, whether it's building in a little bit of headroom in the spending, but that could encourage, you know, growth in expenditures, or creating mechanisms that create exceptions for certain types of spending so that you know you have flexibility in the future. You also want to avoid unintended consequences or disincentives for behavior you want to encourage, such as putting away short-term savings or saving short-term revenue increases, putting them into savings. You want to make sure that your expenditure, your appropriation limit doesn't incentivize behavior you don't want it to incentivize. You don't want it to be an expenditure target. You don't want to be always trying to spend up to the limit. You want it to be something that is there to constrain and not to encourage spending.
Questions from committee members? Senator Wilikowski?
No questions.
Senator Olson?
Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
Any questions before we go to the
next? No, I don't have any questions on that. I thought it was a fairly good presentation, although there are some issues that need to be directed, especially when we're looking at a resolution to do a change to the Constitution. And I'm going to drill down a little deeper into it.
Thank you. I apologize for not calling on you at the end of the second slide. Senator Stedman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Are we going to, by chance, cover the current status? You know, one of the things, whenever we adjust the spending limit, spending cap, we got to take a look at where we're at. And are we going to take a look at our operations at roughly $4.5 billion, rounded off? And is that a, you know, a good point to be? Or should we be at $3 billion? Or should we be at $5.5 billion? And how do we benchmark that relative to population and inflation over the history of the state, or at least going back to the 70s anyway, before the oil boom or the beginning of the oil boom, to make sure we don't end up with a benchmark error as we go through this process? We can have some, maybe a little assistance from OMB on that.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Stedman. Actually, I would sort of step back to the prior slide to kind of talk through that, because when you look at the dark line that represents the current spending limit, you can see that it started roughly in line with UGS spending in that first year. And just note that when you go back this far, you know, the way spending was categorized was a little bit different in history, so this isn't a perfect representation. But you can see that the growth of population and inflation far exceeded the growth in expenditures, so that, you know, where we're at now in fiscal year 22, you know, adjusted for population and population and inflation is significantly lower than, you know, the early 80s if you adjust it forward for population and inflation. So that baseline that we're at now is much lower than it was back then. But really, the what's the appropriate size of the current fiscal year budget for the state of Alaska, you know, that discussion, that decision is, you know, is the annual budget process. So this constitutional appropriation limit, you know, it's not trying to make judgment calls necessarily on all of the items that go into that $4.5 billion, but just trying to set a framework by which we, you know, set a limit on what gets added to that $4.5 billion.
Any further questions, Senator Stubblefield?
Just a comment. My recollection is, if you go back, I know the early 80s were already in the oil boom, but if you even go back to the early 70s, mid 70s, we're about on par, adjusted for inflation and population in our expenditure side. And I think that, Mr. Chairman, is why we've had such difficulty under the last two governors, includes the current one, all the way back to the last year of Governor Parnell, having our agencies under the last year Governor Parnell was $4.5 billion. We've got it down to 3.9, but it's been running sideways since the second year of Walker when he hit 3.97. So the point I'm trying to make is there's always the comments that expenditures far exceed the ideal for the state of Alaska. You know, we should be able to cut the budget to make everything balance, including whatever dividend flows we want. But the financial reality is we've been horizontal, you know, pretty much since 2016 in our expenditures under different legislators, the 29th, the 30th, the 31st, now into the 32nd legislature. So just a little background, you know, so we don't get ourselves into a benchmark error. And we have, as mentioned earlier, over that time frame, we've been building up significant deferred maintenance, not dissimilar to what was done in the 90s, in the very early 2000s, where we walked into hundreds and hundreds of millions of deferred maintenance that this table had to deal with when we had some financial capacity to do it. And if we hadn't done it, our infrastructure would be just in shambles. So we need to be a little careful, Mr. Chairman, as we go forward, I guess, with make sure we don't make a benchmark error here.
Mr. Steininger, could you back up just one slide again? So, I mean, just to reinforce what the co-chairman said, just look at the revenue versus the UGF spending from 82 to 06. Right? And then take into his comments from 16 till today on those same two lines. So you got all that pent up demand for deferred maintenance for 20 years that would have never happened if we hadn't had that anomaly that you mentioned when we had the run up in oil prices. So I think that's all we're saying is, now go to your next slide and I'll follow up with my finish my comment. Let's go back to slide 3. Responsive to long-term anticipated changes, and your next bullet avoids unintended consequences. Those are two key bullets that we have to make sure is right. And so my question being, have you modeled this? SJR 5. As far as meeting the needs in the future, like double-digit inflation for a year? And is that going to put us up against the cap? And is it going to be an unintended consequence? And are we going to have to be asking the people for a draw or how, you know what I'm saying? So have you done any of those, war game this any, model this any?
Chair Bishop, since the calculation as it's laid out in SJR 5 is, you know, based on the greater of population or inflation, so it kind of is naturally responsive to, if you had, say, you know, some event in the future of double-digit inflation, it would be responsive to that and allow the state to accommodate, you know, cost increases that may, you know, put burdens on the state because of a high run-up in some, you know, inflationary pressure or, you know, a large influx of population. The modeling, you know, I might pass that to Ms. Schultz in case there might be a little more modeling that you've done that may address this question as well.
Thank you. For the record, this is Caroline Schultz. Mr. Chairman, we have looked at the projections based on Department of Labor's high, medium, and low population projections, as well as recreating different inflation scenarios using historical inflation numbers. So, you know, if you project the next decade of spending, but you take inflation numbers from the 1980s, the appropriation limit does look very different than it would under the current or recent historic low inflation regime. And those are numbers that we can provide to the committee.
Thank you. Any other questions from our two senators online before we move along to the next slide?
No questions.
Please continue. Thank you.
So there are three key policy considerations that actually go into the spending limit that you design. And they're kind of your main levers in designing the spending limit. And that is what is included or excluded in terms of what expenditures you apply the limit to, how you base, you set your base cost, and then how you grow that base cost over time. And so these are really the areas where you can try to design your spending limit to address the, you know, the previous slide of the key considerations to make it effective. You know, this is really where you make those policy decisions to try to design a spending limit that's effective. The current appropriation limit, you know, you can see here what is excluded. It excludes deposits to the permanent fund dividends, bond proceeds, debt service, disaster spending, and then money that, you know, is non-state money, so federal receipts, receipts from other entities, revenues of public corporations, and certain capital appropriations. So there is currently a list in the Constitution that details what should and shouldn't be included in the spending limit. It's based at $2.5 billion in 1982, so our current limit has a fixed base. And that's something that's changed in SJR 5. So rather than a fixed base, we've moved to a moving average. So that allows that base to sort of respond to events. So you don't have, you know, a fixed base that may or may not be appropriate for current year spending and may or may not create constraint over time. But then also how you grow that. And the gross, really, you're looking to have a gross rate that's as closely tied to the real pressures on government spending as you can. But also available for, you know, this is really where that availability of data comes
in. Let's wait a minute. The only thing worse than that's working a night shift and have the day shift working around camp with the backup alarm going. So please continue. I'm sorry for that.
Thank you. So that how you grow from your base, grow your expenditure limit, is really where the current expenditure limit has its faults. Is it's growing by the cumulative impact of inflation and population, which, as you saw on that first slide, is, you know, significantly greater rate than, you know, the cost pressures on government spending. So in SJR 5, we looked at, you know, changing that gross rate, and we're using the greater of inflation or population over the prior 2 years. And so that allows for that some flexibility in terms of, you know, if inflation runs up or we have large population growth, and it allows that ability to grow and respond to those events, but doesn't, you know, overly increase that rate. So it doesn't allow for, you know, exponential growth or allow for, you know, significant growth over and above what's necessary to meet the needs and the services that we provide. But these, you know, these levers and these policy considerations are really, you know, something that's, that, you know, need to be considered as this goes forward to make sure that they really do achieve the goals of, you know, the legislature and the administration in setting a spending limit, and that they don't create any unintended consequences or create any issues as were laid out on the prior slides. And I think in some of the comments, you know, this is where we have these tools to ensure that we have the ability to respond to defer maintenance needs or have the ability to respond to change over time, but don't create incentives for excess spending.
Committee members, questions? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've had, you know, again, this spending cap, the issue before us many, many times over the last couple of decades, particularly the last decade. And there's been a lot of discussion on the permanent fund dividend being in or under the spending cap or out. And apparently this proposal is for it to be out of the spending cap. The Supreme Court has ruled that it's has no more, the dividend has no more right to a first call on the Treasury than anything else. And we're supposed to, as legislators, balance the needs of the state, the entire state, including the dividends and all our other obligations, and come up with a budget. So I'd like to have them explain the reasoning why the permanent fund dividend would be excluded when it's one of our most significant calls on revenue. And then have a follow-up.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, you know, the primary reason the permanent fund dividend is excluded here is that this isn't our only constitutional amendment that we have in front of the legislature. There's another constitutional amendment that would address a permanent fund dividend and set that payment in the Constitution as well. And so, you know, once that constitutional amendment goes forward as well, that would, you know, effectively, you know, control the expenditure of the permanent fund dividend. And so that wouldn't be a, you know, a discretionary item in the state budget anymore under that constitutional amendment. And so since it wouldn't be a discretionary item, there would be no need to include it in an appropriation limit. And so this, you know, this constitutional amendment and this proposal needs to be taken kind of in that context of it's, you know, not on its own, but it's here alongside another constitutional amendment that would address that expenditure out of the Treasury.
So to put it another way, sorry, Mr. Chairman, I just, to put it another way, you're banking on the other constitutional amendment passing. What if it failed and this one passed? To get back to Senator Stedman's original question.
Chair Bishop, you know, the permanent fund dividend still, you know, wouldn't necessarily be, you know, we don't consider it a discretionary appropriation. You know, we consider it something that should be done per the statute. And so while, yes, the Supreme Court has, you know, ruled that it is a, you know, discretionary item as part of the annual budget process, the administration's perspective is that the permanent fund dividend should follow the statute or, you know, the law in terms of the appropriation made. And so it still would be, you know, rules-based and not necessarily a discretionary item that would need to be considered under the cap.
Senator Stedman?
I think the statutory formula is around 3,300, and I think the proposal from the administration is 2,300, so those two numbers aren't equivalent. So clearly, the administration isn't supporting the $3,300 dividend. And the Supreme Court makes a law of the land that we all have to follow, including the administration, they like it or not. And it's the underlying document that we all work off of. And some folks may agree with their decisions or disagree with their decisions, but it's the law of the land. It's the way it is. And we take an oath to uphold the Constitution. So without going down that rabbit trail, I'd like to come back to the main point I want to make is when we structure this proposal, we're setting in place a first call in the Treasury, frankly, for a permanent fund dividend and putting most other things under the spending limit. But the concern I have is there was a deliberate policy set by previous legislators, governors, now they go back 40 years. And we have, over that time frame, paid annual dividends to the people. And that formulation was to be 50% for the dividends out of the realized earnings and 50% to the state after inflation adjustment. So the state never took their 50%. We reinvested it into the portfolio and had the portfolio grow and compound for roughly 40 years, just round numbers. That considerably swelled the value of the permanent fund to roughly $80 billion today, or 82 or whatever it is today, somewhere in that range. Changes every day. And that allowed the dividend to grow. And all of the citizens of the state benefited by that policy, by having the permanent fund grow and the dividends grow for four decades. So I think we need to be very careful when we start excluding the permanent fund dividend that has been have the benefit of that 40-year policy in growth. And as an example, from the presentation yesterday, if we would have followed the Constitution, just the requirements for the permanent fund, the value of the permanent fund for dividend purposes would be roughly $30 billion. And or 29, so we just use 30, and the dividend would be $1,100. So I think we need to factor that in, that when we have a policy that is in place for 40 years to build the wealth of the permanent fund to help the state at the end of the oil era be able to manage its budgets and the communities be able to afford, and people be able to afford to live in a state that's sparsely populated, that we don't just ignore that and set future policy in a vacuum. Because we could have, or our predecessors could have, set aside in another account or a parallel account that other $50 billion in the permanent fund for use to fund the budget. So I think there is some issues here when we start talking about the magnitude of the dividend and should it be in or out of a spending cap, and how much should be in there or out of it. And I know it's not a very, very often commented about that policy of reinvesting the state's half for 40 years, but it, and the additional monies that the legislature has put in to the permanent fund, including this last fiscal year, the year before that, all the other adjustments that have gone through time, it's significant, $50 billion. So yeah, I think we have some issues we need to work through before we try to pass anything in stone or in the Constitution. And I'm so anyway, we'll just leave it at that. That's something that I think this committee should talk about some more, and hopefully the conversation out amongst the public will start to recognize the $50 billion added value that the legislature has made to the permanent fund instead of just, you know, spending the assets along the way, which we could have done.
Question for me to you is, can you define certain capital appropriations and, you know, paint a little brighter picture for me on that, because I'm at a loss. Have you got a list of those certain capital projects?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Caroline Schultz from the Office of Management and Budget. The current constitutional appropriation limit in Article 9, Section 16 has a provision where, under certain circumstances, a certain portion of the appropriation limit needs to be spent on capital. There you go, you have it right there. Under the committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 5, the way that it is drafted allows for capital appropriations that exceed the appropriation limit if voted on and approved by a majority of voters in the state, similar to the provisions required for a general obligation bond. That was added in the Senate Judiciary Committee in order to enable capital expenditures outside the limit, but to make sure that there is some control on them with a vote by the people.
It can only be sewer water projects because of, you know, certain capital projects. So they didn't get definitive on the type of civil projects or vertical or horizontal projects. They just know nothing. Do we know of what they were thinking, or?
Mr. Chairman, the way that it's worded, there is some ambiguity for whether it's a capital improvement or a capital project. The definition of a capital project hasn't been tested in court in Alaska. So if we want to have an extensive conversation on, you know, what qualifies something as a capital project or a capital improvement, and qualifies it for a general obligation bond, for example, or qualifies it as a constitutionally approved capital type project, and whether deferred maintenance counts and whether you can buy an airplane with it, that's a pretty academic conversation that I know that we'd be happy to have. And Assistant Attorney General Bill Milks is also on the line, and this is a particular favorite topic of his.
Thank you. Questions from our fellow senators online?
No questions.
Please continue.
So slide 5 is showing a kind of tighter time frame than was shown on the first slide, with different timings of had this, the appropriation limit under SJR 5, been implemented at different time periods. And you can see that it's, you know, pretty different depending upon when you implement the appropriation limit. So in 2000, that first light gray or light blue line, you can see that it and 2005 are relatively similar. And the reason for that is that time period in the 90s into the early aughts was a time period of relatively flat and stable budgets, very similar to the time period we're in now. And so because they're flat and stable budgets, that three-year averaging that SJR 5 is based on, you know, calculates a fairly similar three-year average both in 2000 and 2005. And so you see a fairly flat, fairly little impact of timing depending upon when you implement this. But when you see an increase in the expenditures leading to 2010, that increases that three-year average. And so that's one important note on that first slide, where you saw that the dotted line was significantly lower than current year spending. That's because it was based off of a time period in 1982 that was much lower than current spending. But if you implement this SJR-5 proposal now or at a time period of higher spending, you know, that initial base is based off of your most recent three budgets. So it's responsive and ensures that when it's implemented, it doesn't implement at a level that would significantly constrain you immediately. It simply is there to ensure you can't run up expenditures right away. So you see that really in this 2010, you know, darker blue line, you know, if it was implemented in 2010, it wouldn't have immediately constrained the 2010 budget. However, it would have prevented, you know, an increase in expenditures in the following couple of years. And then in 2015, you can see kind of another feature of this three-year averaging is that as expenditures go down to meet the decline in revenue subsequent to fiscal year 15, you can see that the three-year averaging brings that appropriation limit down with spending. So really, it only allows growth based on inflation or population from your three-year average. So if you have been making, you know, deliberate decisions to reduce expenditures, you know, it doesn't allow you to turn around and ratchet that back up immediately. Your growth out of that, you know, reduction period is limited to inflation or population. You can also see here during this time period the current constitutional spending limit being, you know, significantly higher than the actual spending that occurred during that time period.
The only comment I had is just, I know you don't have spending, revenue on there, but it still, I think, it goes back to make my point that when we were flat on revenue, we weren't overspending. And when we were spending more revenue, we were catching up on the, I'm just making a point, we were just catching up on the 20 years of deferred maintenance we weren't able to do. But thank you. Any questions? Online, any questions? Next.
So slide 6 is a little more forward looking, and it is using the OMB 10-year plan as well as Department of Revenue's official forecasts. And what this is trying to show is that the spending, the appropriation limit designed in SJR 5 has some flexibility. So it is dependent upon choices you make. So these two black dotted lines kind of represent a range of where the expenditure limit could be calculated in the future. And the top line really is showing if you treat this spending limit as a, you know, spending goal effectively, you try to maximize spending every year, that three-year average then responds to it and increases over time. But if you keep spending flat, you know, the line really, you know, meets what your expenditures are and grows by the rate of inflation or population, whichever is greater. As we projected forward, you know, we kept it fairly simple and used 0.5% annual population growth and 2.25% inflation growth. So when we're looking at the greater of the two, really this just represents a projection of inflation. That range between the two kind of helps to illustrate that as SJR 5 is drafted now, it's responsive to appropriation decisions you make and, you know, stays with the current budget and allows for a small amount of growth but doesn't allow for, you know, a significant fast run up in expenditures.
Questions? Online, we have any questions? Well, if we could maintain our savings discipline there, we might be able to pay the CBR back in 16 years if we could do it at $1 billion a year instead of 130 years if we only do 100 million a year. Please continue.
So slide 7 and slide 8 go into the details of what is in the bill. And one thing to note here as we go through the actual, you know, the actual text and the terms within SJR 5 is that these are the areas where you would want to, you know, look at and consider to ensure that there is that ability to address some of the needs that have been brought up. So things like deferred maintenance or capital appropriations, ensuring that the way this is drafted, allows for the, you know, types of needs that you project in the future for the state. So if a concern is the ability to have, you know, capital appropriations when there's a necessity for deferred maintenance, we want to make sure that there is a stipulation here that allows that, but doesn't allow that at a, you know, a more than prudent rate. So as you look at SJR 5, you know, the key aspects here, we are amending Article 9, Section 16 of the Constitution. It's fixing the calculation to limit spending to say that it may not exceed the prior three-year average by more than the greater inflation or population. It clarifies the definition of the appropriation subject to the cap. This includes both UGF and DGF appropriations, so general fund appropriations, but it excludes permanent fund dividends, bond proceeds, and debt service. Deposits into state savings accounts, so these are state funds that cannot be spent without further appropriation. So, you know, we don't want to limit the ability to save money. Payments towards retirement unfunded liability, disaster response payments, non-state funds for a specific purpose, that's, you know, federal receipts or other funds received for specific needs. And capital projects if approved by voters. So this is similar to a general obligation bond, as Ms. Schultz explained, but simply allows for a similar process without the need to take on debt.
Does the administration have a plan for tackling the deferred maintenance?
Chair Bishop, the current mechanism that we're using to fund deferred maintenance is through the Alaska Capital Income Fund and earnings that go into that fund. The administration is, you know, dedicating that money into deferred maintenance. We're in the process of addressing deferred maintenance on a statewide basis rather than department by department through the Division of Facilities Services. But there is definitely a need to find more adequate funding for deferred maintenance. The amount of money available in the capital income fund is a little bit less than, you know, what a necessarily, you know, the ideal amount if you go by the 1 to 2% of asset value.
Thank you. Senator Steadman?
Yeah, I got a couple of things, Mr. Chairman. On the bond proceeds and debt service costs, one of the concerns I have there is many times over the years we've had discussions on our capital project list, capital budget, and the operating budget, and we've had members in the legislature that wanted to go out and do bonded projects so it wouldn't show up in the capital budget per se, and they can pretend that the budget is 250, 300, 350, or whatever amount the bond package is going to be lower than it actually is. And then we end up doing that head fake. And then we issue the bonds, and then the bonds roll in as annual debt service, which is an expenditure, an obligation we have to make. So I think we'd have to take a look at these bond proceeds. I'm not convinced that they should be excluded. And we've had numerous discussions, including this year, over the bond packages and why they're there, and should they be pushed forward or not. But clearly there's budgetary manipulations that make bond packages more attractive over the short run than, frankly, they should be. So that's one concern, Mr. Chairman. And then taking the capital projects to a vote to the voters, a lot of times we don't have time to do that. If there is a federal monies that come in and other things, and frankly, that's what we're elected to make those decisions. And if we don't make good decisions, then the public will replace us. So I'm a little concerned about that issue also. And if you, the other side note I'd like to point out, if we do capital budgets by the voters, there isn't an equal distribution of population around the state. Clearly it's imbalanced in the geographical areas. And we spend many hours every budget cycle trying to make sure that the call on the Treasury is equally fair around the state, not concentrated in one particular geographical area or one or two communities. And we set that out. And I'm not so sure that having something like this embedded in the system, you know, going to the voters, that the capital project issues would be just concentrated in the population centers. So I'm a little bit gun shy on that. And we can bring up, and you know, in the future when we talk about this issue, I'm sure we can all bring up numerous examples of when there's been a less than fair allocation of resources around the state. And I don't think we have to go back very far in history.
Senator Hoffman, did you have a question, sir?
No.
Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, either one of you have a question?
No questions.
I have no questions, Mr. Chairman.
Just before we leave this slide, Mr. Steininger, I was assuming when we were talking about these capital projects and you gave the analogy, is this particular just to the GO bond list only? And or are you taking, like Senator Stebbins said, our ability to wait to have a capital budget normal traditional process at the table?
Chair Bishop, under SJR 5, you would still have your normal capital budget process that would be, you know, subject to legislative control. The capital projects, if approved by voters, or GO bonds, would simply be, you know, if there is a situation where the legislature wished to exceed the appropriation limit, if there was a need for capital projects over and above that, then you could, you know, make the choice to send to the voters capital projects that exceeded the cap. You'd always be able to still, you know, make a decision on capital appropriations up to the appropriation limit without going to the voters. This is only in a situation where, say, there's excess revenue, you want to utilize some of that excess revenue for additional capital projects over and above the appropriation limit. It would allow for, you know, the voters essentially to condone a, you know, an expenditure in excess of the limit. So it provides a little bit of a relief valve at times when there may be excess need, but you still would retain that right to the normal capital budget process.
Senator Stedman.
This is a footnote. Let's remember that the capital budgets we've had in the immediate past have been basically federal match only. There has been some additions, but not a lot. So again, we come back to the benchmark error question. And how much or what size of a capital budget would spill over into this other category. And I am concerned on equal treatment around the state. And I'm not so sure that this would accomplish that. And we've got some examples in rural Alaska where when the expenditures are in the rail belt, it's not a problem. When the expenditures are in rural Alaska, even though they're substantially smaller, it's a ghastly waste of money. So I'm a little, you know, a little cautious on that. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under your appropriations that are excluded, I believe that an argument can be made that power cost equalization should be included as an exclusion expenditure. And I say this primarily because what was the purpose of power cost equalization? There were expenditures made in along the rail belt to reduce energy costs for the rail belt in many different areas. So those expenditures have been made. They're never going to be included. And this fund was to try to equalize those expenditures. So there were no infrastructures to reduce costs in rural Alaska. So the fund was set up to counter those previous expenditures. So I would say that there's strong arguments that can be made that that those future expenditures should be excluded as well, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman for his comments. Senator Wilikowski or Senator Olson?
No questions.
No questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just one more item before, because it's more on this subject than the next slide. Just thinking of ways that things get manipulated. Under the current enacted budget, there's about 198.7, or just say 200 million in expenditures that weren't made. Oil tax credits, school bond debt reimbursement, REA school funding, community assistance, those things. So that knocks 200 million off. So we take a three-year average, and we take 200 million in this current year. That drops that average down. That wasn't a policy by the legislature. That was a policy by the executive branch. And frankly, there's a lot of us that don't agree with it, but that's what it is. So that puts those expenditures out of the calculation for the next three years. And in the event that we had a governor that wanted to play that game for 4 years in a row, he could play that veto game and keep driving down those limits and or the spending limit. And there is a difference, in my opinion, between a policy decision to increase the expenditures of education, healthcare, university, corrections, public safety, all our agencies, than the discussion of paying our bills that are due. And I think we need to bifurcate that also and consider that, Mr. Chairman. There's definitely a difference between growing the operating budget and making our obligated payments. And I'm not so sure that this proposal doesn't start hindering our ability to make our obligated payments. So I just want to make that note, you know, when we consider, you know, the three-year average of past expenditures, that there is definitely manipulations that can take place for political gamesmanship and maneuvering versus not.
Senator Wilson, did you have a question, sir? Please continue.
So SJR 5 also makes amendments to Article 9, Section 17 of the Constitution, the Constitutional Budget Reserve section. It amends Section 17A to clarify deposits into the fund. This is to address a difference in interpretation of the current language and make it a little bit clearer to ensure that, you know, it can be consistently interpreted and, you know, kind of remove some just clarify the types of deposits. What it does is it addresses language on what types of settlements go into the Constitutional Budget Reserve and clarifies that they're settlements that are directly related to oil, gas, and mineral resource issues. It also removes 17B. 17B is a section of the Constitution that currently allows for a simple majority access to the Constitutional Budget Reserve under certain circumstances. Those circumstances haven't ever been triggered, to my knowledge, in terms of accessing the CBR with a simple majority. So it's not been used, and it was removed through an amendment in Senate Judiciary. It also retains the access through a three-quarter vote, so it still keeps that additional bar or additional higher bar of spending from the constitutional budget reserve and retains the repayment provisions. These are both changes that happened to the bill. The original version eliminated the three-quarter vote and repayment provisions.
Senator Stedman.
We have used the access to the permanent fund, to the CBR, and without the three-quarter vote in the relatively near past. But the three-quarter vote, if you have a three-quarter vote need requirement every time you access the CBR, I have never seen the access to the three-quarter vote being less expensive to the Treasury. It's more expensive to the Treasury. And legislators want to leverage their vote for a water line, a sewer line, a fire station, a school, or, you know, operating budget increases, whatever budgetary issue they have dealing statewide or with their district for their vote, but it's never to decrease the draw, it's to increase the draw. So when we've used and had access to the CBR in the past, and I think Senator Hoffman was here with me when that took place, it didn't cost us extra funds to do it. And we created the statutory budget reserve, that's a simple majority vote, because it's a simple majority vote. And we don't have to pay budgetary ransom to make our ends meet and escalate our costs. And to give folks at home a concept of magnitude, a couple years ago, we had an option of about $50 million from one group and about $130 million from another group to get a budget down after we've taken the work at the table. All of it was an increase in costs. It wasn't a decrease. So I think we need to seriously consider this issue also as not something that's going to help us control expenditures, that's going to actually escalate it. Because in a year, your reoccurring revenue doesn't equal your reoccurring expenditures and other expenditures. You have to go to the savings account, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, for a backstop. That would also include, Mr. Chairman, just I'm probably talking more than I should today, but when we expense in the budget cycle all our reoccurring revenue against all our reoccurring expenditures, which we have done this year, we normally, under most years, have backstop language. In other words, we put language in the budget that would allow a draw on the Constitutional Budget Reserve to balance the books through the year, especially in the spring. And that takes the three-quarter vote access to the CBR. When we don't have the three-quarter access to the CBR, which we do not have today, we do not have backstop language. And we're looking at, in this current scenario in front of us now, in real time in the legislature, somewhere around, what, $60 million or so? And if we backstop, depending on how we deal with the dividend, and if we backstop the scholarship funds, that'll be another 20-some million. We'll be down somewhere around 30 million or some numbers offhand in cushion. So, just to get backstop language to match reoccurring expenditures with reoccurring revenue, we're going to have to pay ransom and drive our costs up. It's just counterintuitive than the intent of putting this three-quarter vote in many, many years ago, but clearly that's what takes place in this building. It is very expensive money. And we've had numerous discussions on that, especially Senator Hoffman and myself over the years, 20 years, on how expensive this provision is. And it just pushes up our operating costs. So I'm a little gun shy on this one also.
So in a nutshell, if you're wanting to save money on the state budget, in my opinion, a three-quarter vote ain't the way to go. tax us, the CBR. It's just driving up the cost. Next question online from either our colleagues online on this page.
No questions.
No question, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I guess we're at the point where you're going to walk us through a sectional, Caroline. Is that correct?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. This is Caroline Schultz for the record. We touched on the bulk of the amendment during the presentation, but I will briefly walk through a sectional with the committee, and I will also point out changes that were made in the prior committee. So section one, that's the bulk of the legislation. This amends the appropriation limit that's currently in the Alaska Constitution. The new subsection A begins by listing the appropriations that are excluded from the appropriation limit that we discussed. Starts with appropriations made under the new subsection B, which is in section two, we'll discuss that. Permanent fund dividends, deposits to the permanent fund, appropriations of GO and revenue bonds, and the debt service payment on those bonds. Appropriations to a state savings account or a fund that requires a subsequent appropriation. This was a clarification that was made in the Senate Judiciary Committee to clarify exactly what constitutes a deposit to a state savings account. Appropriations for the payment of the unfunded liability of a state retirement system is excluded. This was also added in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Appropriations to meet a disaster and appropriations of money from a non-state source and trust for a specific purpose, which of course includes federal funds, and then it was added in the Senate Judiciary to clarify that revenues of a public corporation are also excluded from the appropriation limit. Section one also sets forth the new appropriation limit that we discussed that's based on the average of the appropriations in the prior three fiscal years, multiplied by the change in the greater of inflation or population over the last 2 years. Section two, which starts on page two at the bottom, is the new subsection B in Article 9, Section 16, which permits appropriations for capital projects in excess of the limit if approved by voters. We discussed that. That was also added in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Section three begins the changes to the CBR section, which makes limited changes to section 17A, as discussed earlier, clarifying what defines as a required deposit into the CBR. Section four, partway through page three, is transition language that gives us time to ensure transition time for the appropriation limit to take effect. Section 5 at the bottom of page 3 repeals subsection B of the Budget Reserve Fund, which is the current allowance to make a simple majority appropriations from the CBR under certain circumstances. And section 6 requires that the amendment be placed on the ballot in the 2022 general election.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Seeing none, our next meeting is this afternoon, September 9th, 2021 at 1 p.m. And agenda will be forthcoming. We are adjourned at 10:13.